It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Hello and welcome to South Beach Sessions. This is Dan Le Batard, and I believe that what you're about to hear is one of my favorite conversations that we've ever had on South Beach Sessions. I admire this man's work so much, the meticulousness of the crafts, the craftsmanship and the sculpting, the honor to truth, and the care that he takes with these projects that seem breathtaking in scope. Ken Burns is a creative hero of mine just because of how he makes things. And so we deconstruct the creative process for him, where it comes from, and he gives you the objective truth as he sees it in his films, but also he talks very strongly about America's history. So I hope you enjoy this as much as I did, because I found it illuminating as well as fun as PBS can be, because you don't associate PBS with echoing laughter across the eternities. But this is a loose Ken Burns. I don't think that you guys have seen him this way. And so I enjoy this conversation. I hope you do too.
A lot has changed over the years, kind of like who's the best hockey team in Florida. But one thing that hasn't, the great taste in Miller Lite. Another thing that hasn't changed is that it's less filling. So what's the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite sparked this debate in 1975, and we still haven't settled it. Right now, the great debate is if my team will make it past the second round. We can fight about this all throughout the series, but there's one thing that's for sure. I'll be yelling at all of you while drinking a nice ice-cold can of Miller Lite. It's my preferred light beer when arguing about sports with other people. Miller Lite keeps it simple. Undebatable quality, great taste, and only 96 calories. It's the beer that strips away everything that you don't need and holds on to what matters most. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right at your door, visit MillerLite.com/beach, B-E-A-C-H. Or you can get it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
A giant fan of this man's work. He takes really, really hard things to do and makes them well, makes them thoroughly. A tapestry as a documentarian. He really is an artist. We are pleased to have at Metalark Media Lynn Novick, who has helped him with many of his projects. But Ken Burns, I've told you off air and I'm telling you on air, I just can't believe the things that you tackle and the degree of difficulty. You've got an Ali film now. Everything has been said about Ali. This subject matter has been covered, but you love tackling things that that are hard to tackle.
Well, thank you. First of all, this is a film that is co-directed by Sarah Burns, my daughter, and her husband, David McMahon. We collaborated on the Central Park Five and Jackie Robinson. We felt that there are lots of really good films on Muhammad Ali. I mean, really, in many cases, great films on Muhammad Ali. Some take a particular fight, some take a couple of years in his life. None we felt were doing what we're always interested in, is that kind of soup to nuts, from birth in the 40s in Jim Crow Louisville, Kentucky, to death by Parkinson's not that many years ago, 2016, and all that's in between. So not just boxing. In the course of our film, you'll get inside maybe 25 boxing matches with the help of a lot of commentators and sports writers who were there, and the help of Michael Bent, the former heavyweight champion, who's so fantastic. But you also get to know about his childhood and how he got into boxing, his early years of boxing, his wives, four of them, his children, his friends, the intersection with the Nation of Islam and with Islam in general, the American Civil Rights Movement, of course, his refusing induction into the draft in the U.S. Army. So it's a contextualized Muhammad Ali. But what comes through is that he is, without a doubt, the greatest athlete of the 20th century, probably the greatest athlete of all times. But he's also this avatar, this kind of prophet of love and kindness that made him, when he died in 2016, he died the most beloved person on the planet, which is, you know, something the rest of us can only dream of.
You say that, but Jim Brown famously said of Muhammad Ali, he didn't become America's, he didn't go from America's most hated athlete to its most beloved until he lost his ability to speak. When he had the microphone, you stripped down Hemingway uncomfortably. You stripped down Hemingway and took a lot of the myth away. I'm guessing that Muhammad Ali probably falls on the right side of history so often that you see he's even better than you thought he was. Do I have that wrong? Or did you, were you able not to strip this away where...
You have it exactly right, Dan. It's very thoughtful and astute. The last film I did on Ernest Hemingway didn't end so well. It ended with a self-inflicted shotgun blast alone in Ketchum, Idaho. This ends with somebody who has punched through. But Jim Brown is absolutely right in one way. That is to say, Muhammad Ali was one of the most divisive figures of the 60s and early 70s. But I would suggest it was less the Parkinson's that brought him back to us than the fact that he was right on so many things. When he comes back after 3.5 years of absence at the height of his career and loses to Joe Frazier after winning a couple of bouts, he becomes a champion. He gets up on that last round after he's knocked down, and he still fights on, and he's incredibly modest and incredibly well-spoken afterwards. He talks about everyone having loss in their lives, and people lose jobs, and they lose loved ones, and they lose titles. And he was trying to say that he had a responsibility to all those people that are going to lose things, meaning everybody. And then, of course, he comes back and reclaims the title and does it yet again. And then, you know, I'm reminded by your excellent question, or Jim, you know, channeling Jim Brown, of something Michael J. Fox said, the actor who also has Parkinson's. He said, "I couldn't be still until I couldn't be still." I think in some ways, Muhammad Ali couldn't really speak, as great a speaker, as funny a speaker, as wonderful, as challenging, as just right a speaker as he was, until he couldn't speak. I mean, somehow he continued doing what he said he was going to do, which is serve others. He said, service to others is your rent for your room in heaven. And that was Muhammad Ali. And his daughter Rashida at the end of the film says, you know, boxing was just this much, just a tiny part of it. And he could have been something else, like a simple carpenter. And we know where simple carpenters go. So I just think it's a complicated dynamic. And this is what's been so gratifying, is that people within his circle, people within his family, the critics, some of the historians who know about him said, wow, I learned things about Muhammad Ali I thought I knew and I didn't know. And that's music to our ears. They're seeing footage that they have never seen before. They're seeing still photographs. We spent 7 years on this. We're obligated to try to give you a kind of dynamic and nuanced Ali with all the undertow there. We don't pull any punches. No pun intended, you know, the warts and all. When he fails or when he has failings, we are quick to point them out. But all in all, he's one of the most amazing human beings I've ever gotten to know.
Tom Juneau, one of the great magazine writers ever, was an atheist when he went to go visit Mr. Rogers. And he left that experience so admiring just the kindness of Mr. Rogers that you can say he found God, a lifelong atheist. Yes. When you're doing this on Muhammad Ali, do you come away moved by just what he endured, the arc of the story, and how he was ahead of his time on race relations and on love?
That's exactly it. What a good way to say it. I don't know how I could improve on it. Yes, he is a transcendent figure. That means whatever the sum of his parts equal, there's always something more. And I think all of us are curious about that. We live in a world, a binary world, that's interested in good and bad, right and wrong, on and off, and it just doesn't work that way. We also live in a world in which one and one equals two, and it has to equal two. Otherwise, bridges don't stand, buildings collapse, lots of stuff doesn't occur. But the thing that we're most interested in is when one and one equals three. We looked at for that in our relationships, in our love, in our faith, in our art, whatever it might be. And that's what Ali delivers all the time, just a sense that there is an improbable calculus in the world, and he understood it better than just about anybody. Louis Armstrong is the only other person I've come in contact with, an American, that has come to understand the possibility of love. This is a four-letter word the FCC allows you and me to use all the time, but we don't use it that often because it's so hard, it's so embarrassing, it's so misunderstood, it seems so inappropriate or awkward for many people, and yet that's his overwhelming message. And you know, billions of people were drawn to him and his story. Billions. Nobody else. I don't know anyone else who could say that.
What drew you to this story? You must pick your projects meticulously. The degree of difficulty on your projects is ridiculous.
Well, you know, we're drawn because it is a good story. And that's what we're in the business of. It's story, 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 number one, two, and three. And this is great. It has majesty. It has complication. It has contradiction. It has controversy. It has undertow, and that's really important. We live in an age where we lament the absence of heroes because we presume that heroes are somehow perfect. The Greeks have been telling us for thousands of years that heroes aren't perfect. Achilles has his heel and his hubris to go along with his great great strengths. And so it's the negotiation, sometimes the war between someone's inner strengths and weaknesses that defines heroism and, of course, defines a good story. So this is a classic American story. This is a hero's journey, a rags-to-riches story. It's the story of America's age-old question of race. There's a moment, Dan, really wonderful moment when the Supreme Court exonerates him. He's been convicted of avoiding the draft and refusing induction and sentenced to 5 years. He loses 3.5 years of the prime of his career. Supreme Court unanimously, on a technicality, let him go. And somebody asks him, a reporter sticks a mic in his face and says, "What do you think about the system?" And he says, "You know, well, I don't know who's going to be assassinated tonight. I don't know who's going to suffer injustice or inequality." And so here is this guy who could be lauding his great victory. And instead, he looks back to 350 years of the treatment of African Americans on this continent, thinking about Emmett Till, whose open casket he, as a boy, almost the same age as Emmett Till, saw, and it deeply affected him, all the way back to 1619. And then, of course, all the way forward to things he couldn't possibly know that were yet to come, like Rodney King and Trayvon Martin and Tamir Rice and Breonna Taylor and George Floyd. And so he was speaking, yeah, okay, so I got it, but this doesn't mean the struggle is over. And to have that kind of composure and be still in your 20s, I think, or early 30s is just
mystifying. It's lunacy. It's lunacy because he was 60 years ahead of his time, and we still don't have an athlete who can tackle this stuff with the facility he did.
Exactly right. And people say, well, aren't the modern day athletes who are using their position to social media? They're very important. I can only think of, you know, Carlos and Smith from his time, who suffered the ultimate, you know, penalty for speaking out by raising their fists at the 68 Olympics. And then Colin Kaepernick. I mean, you could say Kurt Flood, too, because he was the first trial balloon against free agency, and that was it. Goodbye, Kurt. And it would take a couple of white guys to begin to make the process happen. But Colin Kaepernick suffers. So, you know, when people are standing up for things, which is really important, and people in sports shouldn't shut up and dribble, they should do whatever they want to do and say the things, they're really important spokespeople out there, they're not putting it on the line in the way that Muhammad Ali. He said, "I'd face a firing squad, I'd face a machine gun, rather than go against my religious teaching, which was to go fight in a war." And you know, that takes an extraordinary amount of courage, well beyond what we see today. And he is still teaching us today. That's what's so interesting, that his life can intersect with all the major themes of the last half of the 20th century, but he's intersecting with everything that's going on today, good and bad. And he's speaking to it. And there's a wonderful shot towards the very end of the film of a young black woman in protest across the Brooklyn Bridge. And we consciously don't tell you what the protest is about. It's just a cutaway from something that one of our commentators, Howard Bryant, is saying. But she's wearing a T-shirt, just a simple black T-shirt, and it says Muhammad Ali on it, as if that alone was enough to go, phew, you know, that's it. Muhammad Ali. Do I need to say anything more?
I want to talk to you about the project some more, and I don't know how much time we have with you, but I just love a lot of your details and a lot of your work. So before we get back to Muhammad Ali, I'd just like to get to the roots of how you became this as a creator. What in your childhood drew you to the roots of, I want to tell stories that take 7 years to tell?
Yeah, well, the biggest thing is that my mom got sick with cancer when I was two or three and died a little bit short of my 12th birthday when I was 11. And that's the defining moment. Everything. There's not a day that it goes by. And my late father-in-law was an eminent psychologist. And he said, what do you think you do for a living? You wake the dead. You make Abraham Lincoln and Jackie Robinson and Louis Armstrong come alive. Who do you think you're really trying to wake up? And so I think a lot of this sort of attention to deep and complicated stories. Also, my mom was really sick at a time when the civil rights movement was happening. And so I remember this extraordinary anxiety as a little boy of 9 or 10 as the dogs and fire hoses at Selma and the truncheons were unleashed on innocent people. And I kind of transferred the anguish of the cancer that was killing my family to the cancer that was killing my country. And so I've always been interested in as deep a dive as you can do in American history. And you can't even scratch the surface without coming up against race. And I don't mean to separate it and segregate it and wait until February to show it in Black History Month. I mean, it's just part of everything. Like, we know why we were founded on this one sentence. You know, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. And the guy who wrote it owned hundreds of human beings and didn't see the hypocrisy. I mean, that is got to be part of how we deal with things. I've done a biography with Jefferson that is both laudatory and incredibly critical. And that's right too. And as you'll see, you know, as you know from the tough time we gave Ernest Hemingway, and you'll see the tough time we give Muhammad Ali, it's really a kind of means testing. We don't do Valentines. We do complicated stories, and everybody's complicated. And so what happens is we've got a country that tries to pretend that it can sanitize and make into a Madison Avenue commercial our history. And you cannot do that. It's much more complicated, but hallelujah, it is much more interesting to tell a more complete story. And it widens the lens. It gives more people more voices. It gives more cast of characters. It shows the push and pull of things that sanitized version just never does. It's not satisfying. I'm so surprised that Texas is trying to change their laws to teach only a perfect version. You can't say anything bad about slavery, because Texas, its religion is football. And on a Friday night in high school and on a Saturday afternoon in college, they're going, we stunk. We were pretty good on defense, but we're terrible on offense and special teams. We really need to do work, or everything seemed to be clicking, but there's a sense that the truth, what actually happened, is important to your future success. And if you want to succeed as a football team or a country, you need to be absolutely sure of exactly where you are, good, bad, and otherwise, at any moment. And those are the kinds of stories that we're interested in, we're being drawn to. And yeah, the degree of difficulty has always got to be tough, because you want to say it's not as simple as you think. Think about all of the self-sacrifice of World War II. People have victory gardens turned in scrap. One quarter of every transaction made during World War II was in the black market. So yeah, people saved their bacon grease, people saved their scrap, people knitted stuff, did their victory gardens. It was all good. But one quarter of the country was trying to get it on the cheap, gasoline or whatever it might be. And that's just true and part of the story. Like, we stunk on special teams.
I was just going to ask you why and how you go from New Hampshire farm to racial theories in just about every deep dive that you're doing and tackling race head on. How did that happen is what I was going to ask you, but you just answered, didn't you?
Yeah, and I've lived here for 42 years, Dan, this week, because I moved here when I was working on my first film and realized in New York that I had to get a real job, or otherwise I'd put that film that I'd shot up on the top of the refrigerator and wake up 25 years later and it wouldn't be done. And so I went to some place where I could live for nothing and figure out how to make films in history. But the point is that I don't necessarily go looking for it. Race is the central question. It's what historians say is our original sin. I mean, how can you say, create a country based on distilling the Enlightenment into one remarkable sentence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, and then not address the fact that since 1619, you've been holding other people as slaves. It didn't compute then, and people began to speak up about it. 85 years later, the Civil War started, you know, and we're still, you know, the first progress in civil rights after the Civil War is Jackie Robinson walking out onto a baseball diamond on April 15th, 1947. This is way too long for this stuff to still be going on. And, you know, Chris Rock, the comedian, says, look, you know, I'm a multimillionaire and none of you would trade places for me with a second. So, you know, this stuff has been going on for too long. We need to have a much more inclusive and a much more equitable way and a much more diverse way of telling our histories. And so I've just tried to do my little part in PBS, just saying that, you know, if you're going to tell about World War II, race is going to be part of it. Obviously, if you tell the story of Jackie Robinson or Muhammad Ali, race will be part of it. But it's true of the national parks. The first defenders of the parks were the Buffalo Soldiers, the woolly-haired African-American cavalrymen who protected the park from poachers and hunters. So it's just around and an important part of who we are. In fact, a lot of critics and a lot of friends even and colleagues would say, would you stop talking about race? And when Barack Obama was elected, they would say, now will you shut up? And I held up the copy of The Onion that said, black man given worst job in country. And I said, just watch what happens. And, you know, all we've seen since 2008, and, you know, in the last 13 years has just been stuff we never thought would happen. Retreat on things we thought we'd gotten past. People would say, would you please be quiet about it? We're post-racial. If there's anyone out there that thinks we're post-racial, please raise your hand.
Help me with this, Ken, because as a documentarian, you are interested in fact-soaked objective truths. My guess is that I could say of Ken Burns' work, he's not trying to tell you his truth with a slant or an agenda. He's trying to give you all of the facts so that this is the truth as close as he could come to it with 7 years of meticulous care. So you are objective as a historian.
There's no such thing as objective. We're all subjective. We bring our own baggage, the selection we do. You know, this 8 hours of Ali had 50 times that in the amount of material that we collected. So you can't, you know, you're always going to make a selection. Storytelling is itself the editing of human experience. So everything is going to have a degree of subjectivity, and everybody obeys the same laws as storytelling. Steven Spielberg obeys the same laws that I do. The only difference is he can make stuff up. I can't make anything up. But by selecting to tell this story, to emphasize the second day on Little Round Top in the Battle of Gettysburg and not do Culp's Hill and more time on this, I'm influencing stuff like that.
It aspires to be a fair recall historic events. And here you are you're not being objective, and I happen to find you on the right side of truth, but the way that you speak of race in this country is not in any way whitewashed. You are speaking of it as the plain sort of same truth, but with a degree of indignation behind it. I'm surprised still to see, you tell me, as a thorough researcher of this stuff, I badly underestimated how bad the race problem was in this country. And I was polarizing and left Disney, at least in part, because I wouldn't shut up about race.
Yeah, well, that I applaud you for it. That's the problem. I think everybody was like, now we're post-racial, we don't have to talk about it. But tell that to Tamir Rice's mom. He's a 12-year-old kid with a plastic gun in a Cleveland park. Tell that to Trayvon Martin that's just going for a jog in a Florida suburb. Tell that to Breonna Taylor, who's just sitting in her bedroom, you know, and it's an oops, wrong mistake. Tell that to George Floyd. You know, these are people that are murdered. None of us, you know, I always thought that COVID, in 2020, it reminded us a little bit, we were able to have a little bit of a racial reckoning. Well, now we say it so often that it's not happening. That in large part because it was never a problem for us to go to the convenience store. White people to go to the convenience. Now it was, you know, am I going to get sick? Am I going to get this disease? Am I going to die? And all of a sudden, if you had a brain in your head or a more important, something beating in here, you would say, my goodness, this has been mothers never knew in 1890 whether their kid was going to come home from school. You know, alive. I mean, this is a story, and this is us, as much of all the wonderful things that we've done. And my films document those wonderful things as well. It's just really important that we are honest about what's going on. And it doesn't take, as Bob Dylan said, a weatherman to tell you which way the wind is blowing.
Did you underestimate it? As a thorough chronicler of facts gathered about what America's fabric is, did you, Ken Burns, get surprised by how bad it is?
No. No, I'm disappointed by what's been going on now, the sort of eating away and the eroding of voting rights, the voter suppression stuff, the civil rights bill and the voting rights bill of the mid-60s. I was stunned that people could figure out a way to justify to do that. So I guess I'm surprised in that regard, but I'm not surprised at all by the presence of this. It's been around for as long as there are people, and particularly so in the unique dynamic of the United States, particularly with all its promise and its expectation of exceptionalism, that if you do expect you to be exceptional, then you certainly have to behave like it. And the only way you can behave like it is to go back through your closet and say, what did we do wrong? What are we doing wrong? How can we do better now and in the future? Because lives are at stake.
We've only been a democracy for real for 60 years. Bomani Jones points that out all the time, but it's a jarring. It sort of hits people in the face when you say that. You are looking at the last 4 years, and Ken Burns reacts how?
Well, I think that we're in as great a crisis as we've ever been. I used to say the three great crises were the Civil War, the Depression, and World War II. I think this combination of COVID, the three viruses of COVID, racial injustice that's 402 years old, and the age-old human virus of misinformation, conspiracy, paranoia, you know, lies, all of that are conspiring to put us in an incredibly frightful thing. None of these are without precedent, Dan. Unfortunately, where some of these things have manifested are unprecedented. Never have we had something at the highest office in the land reflect the kind of things that used to be very, very fringe kinds of beliefs, the beliefs that have been around for as long as we've been around. I can take you back to the 1830s and the know-nothings, anti-immigrant, anti-black, anti-Catholic, all of that sort of stuff. It's all there, just as you can go back 100 years to the pandemic before that and see things that look similar. But we didn't have half a nation in total denial about science, right? It's just, and promoted by people who think it's in their political best interest to continue to promote that kind of thinking.
Are you scared?
Yeah, I'm scared for my republic. I feel like my job, I know what my job is supposed to be, and to tell complicated stories about the U.S., but also complicated stories about us. That is to say, the lowercase two-letter plural pronoun. So all of the intimacy of us and all of the complexity and the majesty of the U.S. And what I learned in all of my years is that there's only us. There's no them. And whenever anyone tells you there's a them, run away. And unfortunately, the people who are adept at identifying the other, the alien, the them, have gotten a lot of traction in recent years. And it's, you know, it's too bad we're having deathbed confessions from people saying, oh, I should have gotten the vaccination. It just meant they got their news in the wrong place.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Do you have, and forgive the awkward transition, but a dream project that you have not done? I don't know whether, like Tarantino films, when you've attacked the subject matter you've attacked, you've told, I think you regard it as such, the definitive American story on the telling of whatever that is, from baseball to the Civil War. I'm guessing you could say without too much pride and ego, you are the final word on the subjects that you chronicle, no?
Well, I would not say definitive or final. I would say we're comprehensive. And till the next person comes along and says, I want to talk about this or open up this moment that is, you know, the night in Miami story is two sentences in our film about Ali. And we wrote those sentences well before that movie was even made. And so they exist. And it's like, oh, great. There's somebody who's really opened it up. Definitive is just a ridiculous thing, because you can discover new information, you can learn new stuff, you can discover new archives, somebody shows up as a witness, and it changes everything. So what you want to try to be is comprehensive for the moment. And I feel that very much about the Civil War, very much about baseball and jazz and the national parks and the smaller stuff like the Dust Bowl and Huey Long and the Roosevelts and the Vietnam War, country music, and this Ernest Hemingway, but I have no ego to say that somebody can't come on. PBS is themselves, since 2008, shown three other documentaries on Muhammad Ali. I'm just the fourth.
Is there a project you're proudest of, just because even you regarded, I mean, the Vietnam, I just don't know how you found that, the ability to tell that story. I would also say Hemingway, trying to tell a 6-hour story about words is fairly hard and ambitious,
yeah,
too.
No, they're all, you know, they've all got degrees of difficulty, Dan, and you're very nice to say that. I think that probably Vietnam was the hardest, but they're like my kids. Let me cop out the way Duke Ellington, who's our greatest, I believe, and certainly our most prolific American composer. Somebody asked him, what's his most important composition? He said, the one I'm working on now. So I can talk to you till I'm blue in the face about Ali. And I got another film coming that I'm just finishing on Benjamin Franklin, then another one on the U.S. and the Holocaust, the interrelation of what we knew and what we didn't know, what we did and what we didn't do and what we should have done, all of that complicated stuff that mirrors the racist and anti-immigrant stuff that we hear today. And on, we're doing our next war is a big history of the American Revolution. All of those are floating my boat. Look, I'm 68 years old. If I were given 1,000 years to live, which I am not, I wouldn't run out of topics in American history. And you want to be able to say in conversation with you, which is why I've been with PBS the whole time, this is the secret ingredient. Like, I could go to a streaming service, I could go to a premium channel and get all the money I need to make Vietnam, but they'd never give Lynn and me 10.5 years to do it. They would just not do it. They'd say in 2.5 years. But we raise most of the money. It's a pain in the neck, but we do it. And so when we print it, it's our director's cut. And we can come to you and say, if you don't like this, it's all my fault. That's it. And that's the way it should be. And so I'm working on so many projects, frankly, because I'm greedy. I'm greedy for what happens in our process with the extraordinary people I work with. Lynn is one producing strand. Sarah and Dave are another producing strand. There's two others. We're working on all these different projects at once. And I just can't get enough of it. And all I want to know at the end of the day, when I put my head on the pillow, is that I made one or all of them slightly better, you know, and I can wake up the next morning and go, boy, that idea sucked. Let's undo that and think about this a new way. But, you know, we put our pants on one leg at a time. And the thing is, when a film comes out, that's the signpost for you, the mile marker. For us, it's just a daily process of trying to tell a story that's very complex. And in the beginning, if you came into our editing room and looked at Vietnam, you go, man, Ken, I thought you were good, but this sucks. And then we just polish that. We just work and work and try to make it better until we feel like we've done it. We satisfied the kind of demands that we had of ourselves, and that we've told a good and complicated story.
Your loved ones, is there other places where this OCD sculpting makes an appearance that makes them totally crazy because of the grind of just how, I mean, I don't even know if you could take me sort of through the discipline of what your process is.
The process is pretty simple. First of all, I have four daughters. They're the most important co-productions I have. And they range from Sarah Burns, my oldest, who is pushing 39, I think, and is a mama of her own. And my youngest is the same age as Sarah's daughter. So, you know, I've got a whole spread. My second daughter is a big producer of Samantha Bee and Russian Doll and DeJesus and Mero and Search Party and Broad City and lots of different stuff. She's got the bug, but in a different department. I got a 16-year-old, and they all make films. That's what I care about. The biggest thing I'll say about process is most people work set research period, set writing period, script comes out, written in stone, it informs shooting and editing. We never stop researching and we never stop writing, which means we're open to the very, very end. I've got a neon sign in my editing room, which we're just about to reopen up, and it says in lowercase, cursive, it's complicated. Like every filmmaker, if you've got a scene that's working, nobody wants to touch it. Nobody wants to open it up. Though that's fine. And we open it up. If we find something new that destabilizes it, so be it. Maybe it'll make the two adjacent scenes that much better. But we just want to have the courage to permit there to be undertow. And I think sometimes in our business, and you know it, there's a desire to just streamline it and tell a kind of palatable, easy to digest stuff. And you're not going to get it from us.
What is the tool in your toolbox on that front that you enjoy the most on the work front? Is it research? Is it discovering something? Is it writing? Is it stitching it together? Is it tying it to history? Like, which one is the one that you regard as your most vital?
You know, there's four moments that are really great. You know, when you're out shooting, it might be an archive or your alive stuff, and you know it's going to be in the film. It's just great. You've gotten up at dawn, whatever. You've found some odd thing, and it's great. There's moments in writing that are like that, but to me, and then there's now the evangelistic side. But the most, that is to say, we're out proselytizing. This is the greatest thing since sliced bread. You really have to see it. And I apologize for the animation and the energy, but I love these films down to my soul. But the best part is the editing, where you're just taking stuff and suddenly you see the birth of real story happening, and you go, holy cow, that's great. Or, you know, I did a thing in Vietnam, you know, the Vietnam film. So I just said, run this backwards. Start with this, like, let's just pull a helicopter pushed off the deck of an aircraft carrier out in the South China. Let's pull it back up onto the deck. Let's have the tanks, the NVA tanks, pull, you know, unbreak down the barrier of the presidential palace. Take us all the way. Let's suck the bullet out of the head of the guy assassinated on the streets of Saigon in the middle of the Tet Offensive. Let's have that little girl, Napalm, run backwards into the smoke. Let's go back to that first French troop walking backwards in a swamp. And then let's go forward again. It was just saying, forget everything. Let's just reset. Forget what you think you know about Vietnam. I'll forget what I think I know about Vietnam, which I thought was a lot and turned out to be nothing. Every day of that 10 and a half years was a humiliation. And then let's just re-put it together. You'll see each one of those pieces of film going forward, but you'll see them now in a context and in a rich environment that belies the simplicity of our conventional wisdom, which is the enemy of so many things.
I want to ask you a simple question and a complicated question off that. The simple one is, do you really like puzzles?
I do the New York Times crossword puzzle in ink every day. That's it. But I like trying to figure out what part of a story that you can do. So you would assume, you ask such great questions. So you would presume that making a film is like architecture, right? It's like building a house, right? And it is to some extent. But it's really more, it's less about addition than it is about subtraction. So we have that. I live in New Hampshire, so I'll break down and use the cliched metaphor. We have the 40 gallons of maple sap to make 1 gallon of maple syrup. And so I love that process. The presumption is the cutting room floor is filled with bad stuff. The cutting room floor is filled with great stuff and some stuff that might even be better than any particular thing that's in the film, but it destabilizes the film. And having the ability to work on that and understand the distilling, to kick out the scaffolding, to kick out the false work and go, okay, this is standing on its own two legs. What does it still need? What does the material speak to me? I mean, everybody's about imposing themselves on the material. What's the material telling us? And how do I honor that person who says, oh, I'm interested in Muhammad Ali. I know it's more than boxing, and I'm going to give Ken 8 hours. I am now honor-bound to give you an experience, a cinematic experience that you will not fall out of, that you will attend to. And, you know, and God bless you for giving me that amount of time. And I am honor bound to honor your attention to me.
The hard question when you say that you thought you knew what Vietnam was and you didn't know a fraction of what Vietnam was, when you parse through those horrors, do you see them playing out again in Afghanistan right now in real time across today's news because of what you know
of course,
what this country and what this government is capable of?
Yeah, of course. And it doesn't necessarily point to a very simple good and bad, black and white, you know, kind of thing. It's just, so we like to say history repeats itself. It never, ever has, Dan. It's never repeated itself. The universe would come to a stop if it did. Mark Twain is supposed to have said history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And what that suggests is that human nature remains the same. The Ecclesiastes said, "There's nothing new under the sun," meaning what has been done will be done, what has been will be again. There's nothing new under the sun. So human nature doesn't change, and so we see these themes, these motifs, these rhymes happening all the time. Whenever I finish a film, and I swear to you, we focus intently on getting that film right. You lift up, and then you can't help but be shocked by how much it's rhyming in the present. I could do that with Vietnam, give you the stump speech for that, and blow your mind with how much was exactly what was going on in 2017. But I could do the same thing with the Civil War or the Brooklyn Bridge or the Dust Bowl or Prohibition. All of these things, when you study something in the past and you do a good job about it and you render the people dimensional and real, complicated, then it's going to speak to the present because human beings remain the same. The same amount of greed and generosity, the same amount of purience and puritanism. It's all there, and you can watch it play out in lots of different ways.
I've got 1,000 questions, but we're pressed for time. So I will just leave you this as a promotion for the film. When Ken Burns looks at American history, I want to ask you top three American musicians or top three American artists of all time. But wherever it is and however it is, top three religious figures, Ali and the movie that you're now making. If you were going through all of American history as you know it and saying, I would place him top of the category where in American history?
So he's obviously, I think it was Time and Newsweek and Sports Illustrated all said he was the athlete of the century. So I accept that, and I can have an argument in a bar about the greatest athlete of all time. But let's just say maybe the best way to do this is that if I could have a dinner party with four people besides myself, so a table of five, I would have Abraham Lincoln. I would have Louis Armstrong, I would have Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and I would have Muhammad Ali. I'm as excited about this film as anything we've done, and a lot of it has to do with that thing about him that you thought you knew, and it's really much more complicated and much more interesting.
Very excited to watch it. Thank you for sharing this time. It was a pleasure. Please, let's do it again, because I really do. I have 1,000 more questions.
I could tell. And I give you my word. I'm happy to come back anytime you want, Dan.
I hope we didn't take too much of your time. I know we ran over, but like,
cool.
I just, you're a data bank. It's better than Wikipedia. It's better than Wikipedia. I can ask you anything, and you know the roots across eight decades because you've been studying it your whole life.
I've been, it's like your kids, right? It's why I made that analogy. Once that film's in, if you want me to talk for an hour about my first film, Brooklyn Bridge, that I finished in 80, it was out in 81, I'm happy to talk for an hour about that. or the next film. On
you don't ever get sick of them, huh? You don't want, because when I was listening to you talk, one of the things that I was thinking to myself is, my God, this man has a library of history on the cutting room floor. Like, does he remake that stuff into anything?
No. Because it's like it's a piece of stone brought to the sculptor's studio, right? Whatever we see in the gallery or in the museum is, you know, but she has to honor the negative space of creation. What's not there? What's the rubble on the floor? But that rubble doesn't make part deux in Hollywood's parlance. It doesn't make a second film. I mean, I did revisit baseball with the 10th inning so I could deal with steroids. I could deal with the Red Sox winning my team. I could deal with money. I could deal with the Braves and the Yankees.
Oh, but I wasn't thinking of a second film. I was thinking of telling all those stories so that history doesn't die, telling them in like an audio form.
That's what I want to get. That's what these films are. And I started this website called Unum, after E Pluribus Unum, and it's basically curating the evergreen themes from all the films. So we have like mixtape, if you will, you know, take race or politics or innovation or art or women or whatever it might be. And there's, you can splice together all of these clips.
Fans of your work would love to bury their noses in your cutting room floor.
Go to Unum. It's great. You would love it. It's fantastic.
A lot has changed over the years, kind of like who's the best hockey team in Florida. But one thing that hasn't, the great taste of Miller Lite. Another thing that hasn't changed is that it's less filling. So what's the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite sparked this debate in 1975, and we still haven't settled it. Right now, the great debate is if my team will make it past the second round. We can fight about this all throughout the series, but there's one thing that's for sure. I'll be yelling at all of you while drinking a nice ice-cold can of Miller Lite. It's my preferred light beer when arguing about sports with other people. Miller Lite keeps it simple. Undebatable quality, great taste, and only 96 calories. It's the beer that strips away everything that you don't need and holds on to what matters most. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right at your door, visit MillerLite.com/beach, B-E-A-C-H. Or you can get it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.